It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a disease is threatening to wipe out the world's most popular banana. Coming up, we'll look at efforts to genetically modify the Cavendish banana. That's the one you see at the grocery store before it's too late. First, it's time for a weekly look at some of the top stories in national politics. Tensions between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia continue to grow over the now-confirmed death of journalist Jamal Khashoggi and the shifting story of what happened. Meanwhile, record amounts of money are being poured into congressional races around the country, and thousands of asylum-seeking migrants from Central America are making their way on the 1,000-mile trek toward the U.S. border, setting off another political firestorm over immigration. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is immigration a big issue for you this election season? Has what people are calling a caravan of migrants from Central America heading toward the U.S. affected the way you think about the country's immigration policy? Is this an important issue in national elections, in state elections here in Wisconsin? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Ginger Gibson is a political correspondent for Reuters. Ginger, welcome back to the show.
Glad to be back again.
Now, I want to start with a story that we hadn't planned on talking about, but we have now multiple pipe bombs targeting Hillary Clinton, former President Barack Obama, the news network CNN, billionaire George Soros. These have all been intercepted, none detonated. Developing story, a lot of information out there. Ginger, what can you tell us about this that we know for sure so far?
For sure, we have to start with the fact that no one has, at this point, been injured by one of these devices. We understand that they were live devices. They were not decoys or suspicious packages made to look like bombs. They were, in fact, bombs that were mailed to former President Barack Obama, former President Bill Clinton and his wife Hillary Clinton, to George Soros, a big Democratic fundraiser, gives a lot of money to the party. We also understand one was mailed to Congresswoman Maxine Waters, to her congressional office in Washington. And there was a package that seems to have been mailed to Eric Holder, the former attorney general in Washington, D.C., that was given the wrong address. And so it was sent back, return to sender. And the return to sender was Democratic Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz in Florida. That was where the package was found today. So a number of these packages ending up in a number of places.
And what's been some of the reaction in the political world so far, Ginger?
There has been a quick political response. We've seen a number of Democrats calling on Republicans to condemn the violence or the attempted violence, and arguing that it's President Donald Trump's violent and extreme rhetoric that is prompting some of this action. We know that in any time that there is political violence, we're going to hear political rhetoric around it, and that's a little bit of what we seem to be hearing now. And as well as that, anyone who might be so deranged as to send bombs to former or current elected officials, probably not operating with the clear political understanding that you are and I might, but we are hearing a call for the rhetoric and the temperature to get turned down.
Now, President Trump scheduled to speak today in Mosinee at a campaign style rally here. Are people going to be watching this closely to see if he tones down some of his rhetoric, especially targeting the press as he's done in recent rallies?
There will be a lot of eyes to see how he handles the rhetoric. We did hear him say already in Washington that the country needs to unify, so it was a clear, strong, and unmistakable message that acts of threats of political violence of any kind have no place in the United States. But we do know when he gets off script, when he gets up on the podium and starts talking without the benefit of a teleprompter or aides encouraging him to say something, there is going to be questions about whether or not he turns down some of that violent rhetoric. It was only a week or so ago that he was praising the attack of a journalist in Montana that drew a good deal of scrutiny.
Talking to Ginger Gibson from Reuters, looking at some of the week's top political news stories. We'll keep following developments in that string of pipe bombs being delivered or sent in the mail to political figures. I want to turn now to a foreign policy issue that's been a big story for the Trump administration. Continued political fallout over the now confirmed death of journalist Jamal Khashoggi. Here's President Trump addressing reporters this week about Saudi Arabia.
They had a very bad original concept. It was carried out poorly, and the cover-up was one of the worst in the history of cover-ups. It's very simple.
We've seen a lot of changing stories from Saudi Arabia in what now appears to be a murder of this journalist, Jamal Khashoggi, and changing reactions from President Trump and his administration. What kind of steps are we seeing from the White House and Congress so far, Ginger?
We are seeing a little bit more of the president being critical of Saudi Arabia. It's taken him a little while to get to that position. He sort of began by saying that it could have been done by anyone, that it could have been any attacker or rogue killers. He then now has called it the worst cover-up, suggesting that he is in fact agreeing with what Turkey has said, and that it was the Saudis. We saw today the Saudi crown prince making his first remarks on the subject, vowing to bring to justice the killers, even as he continues to be accused of having been aware or even having helped orchestrate this attack. We see a little bit more aggression from the U.S. government. However, we also see the president saying he's going to wait and let Congress handle this. And that's a real sort of pushing off of making any sort of further decisions or imposing any sanctions. Congress has gone home until at least after next month's midterm elections. They will not be here to do anything. And the process of congressional action is very slow. Even if they were here, it would take them days, weeks, maybe even months to respond, given the process that they must take. So there is signs that we're not going to see any quick, decisive action.
We're talking to Reuters correspondent Ginger Gibson about the top national political news stories of the week. You can join in at 800-642-1234 on our question of the week for you. Will the issue of immigration factor into your vote in just under 2 weeks? Has this large group of migrants heading to the U.S. From Central America, it's getting a lot of media attention from the president. Does it affect the way you think about the country's immigration policy? What do you want to see from the U.S. government in response? Is this a big issue for you, or is it lower down your list? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Reuters correspondent Ginger Gibson, looking at some of the top political news in the nation this week. Ginger, a lot of attention in the media and from the president to this large group, thousands of asylum-seeking migrants from Central America. People are calling it a caravan, still about 1,000 miles from the U.S. border. What has been some of the political reaction to this so far, Ginger?
The president has long held the position that he would like to make the midterm elections about immigration. He thinks that talking about immigrants and stopping them from entering the country largely helped catapult him into the White House, and that he thinks Republicans benefit when the public is paying attention to the immigration issue. So the caravan gaining some attention and some headlines has become a force of which the president wants to be talking about. So we hear him on the campaign trail really sort of trying to bolster fear or concern among his electorate that this caravan is coming to America and that they're coming to do harm. That has prompted Democrats to respond, particularly to the president's tweet that hidden somewhere in this caravan were Middle Easterners. He used just a description of their race, but appearing to suggest that there were terrorists or people attempting to do harm to America sneaking in this caravan, which prompted a lot of criticism from Democrats. So we're definitely seeing this become a political issue and an issue that the candidates are talking about on the campaign trail.
In that that tweet about Middle Easterners allegedly in this group, the president was asked for evidence by reporters. Here's an exchange yesterday.
They could very well be.
But there's no proof.
There's no proof of anything. There's no proof of anything. But they could very well be.
So they could very well be Middle Easterners in that group. What do you make of how do you report on that? First of all, when the president says something with without that, he says without proof.
It is unusual that the president admits that the thing he said comes with no proof, although the press has gotten a good deal of practice reporting on things where we understand there to be no proof behind what the president said. But you're right, he has admitted that there is no proof. The president has been accused by his critics and by others of trapping in conspiracy theories, and that is what they say is happening here, that there is no reason to believe this, that one could argue could just assert there were people that are to be feared all over without proof. And I think that this is an example of him trying to really stoke some fear in the American electorate.
I want to bring on a caller now. Barbara is with us in Delafield. Barbara, hello.
Hi. I'm an immigrant. I came here at the age of 10 in 1949 from Berlin, Germany. At that point, I will have to say the Russians were after my father, okay, because he was working with the Americans. These people that are coming now, they're coming to look for safety and to give their kids a life. They're afraid their children are going to be killed or not have food. I mean, they're not coming to take anything away from Americans. I came here, we had absolutely nothing. Both my mom and my dad worked two jobs. I was the oldest, I was 10. I took care of a 7-year-old and a 1.5-year-old. I was responsible.
Barbara, I'm going to jump in. Thank you for calling and sharing your story. Ginger, Barbara, part of a very wide range of reaction, I think, across the political spectrum to images of this large group of migrants.
That's right. I've been talking to voters in some key congressional districts this past week, and I'm hearing both that sentiment that these are just people coming to find a better life, that they're going to do the kind of jobs that many Americans don't want to do, that people have trouble filling, and that they don't mean any harm economically or otherwise to Americans. But I also hear the opposite, which is that the United States ceases to be able to support more people and that there aren't enough jobs and that those Americans who don't want them to just go do them and stop complaining about not having a job. So this stokes a lot of different opinions across the political spectrum.
Barbara, thanks for the call. We'll go to Steve in Danbury now. Steve, hi.
Hi. I was wondering if hidden deep within this caravan, probably the largest we've ever seen coming north, might be some Republican Party operatives. Is it just me, or does it seem somewhat stretching the bounds of believability to think that this huge caravan is coming north now and going to arrive right around Election Day?
Steve, thanks for the call. Ginger, I've seen people say that. I've seen people from the other side say this is somehow Democratic-funded, George Soros-funded to bring his name up again. There are a lot of conspiracy theories and a lot of misleading information out there about this.
That's right. I think I saw it put best by someone on Twitter, and I could wish I could remember who to give them credit, that if these parties can't organize their own voters in Pennsylvania, what makes you think they've gone and organized voters in Honduras to travel thousands of miles in order to influence the election? It is a bit of a conspiracy theory, I think, to believe that they are being organized by political operatives on either side, although it is undoubtedly going to affect the election. There are all kinds of events in the world that affect the election. We all remember Ebola in 2014. That was not a political conspiracy to influence the outcome of the election, but it surely did influence that election at the time.
Thanks for that call. Let's move on to another election-related issue. Ginger, you recently reported that this year's congressional campaign season is on pace to break some fundraising records. What are we seeing?
We are seeing literally billions of dollars being poured into this election cycle at a rate which is going to set new records. At the end of the third quarter, so the end of the month of September, House candidates of both political parties had raised $1.2 billion, beating the record they held from 2010 at the same point in that election cycle of $1 billion. This is an unprecedented amount of money. We saw election fundraising really stabilize and be plateaued for the last 8 years, but enthusiasm on the left and a lot of candidates running, particularly in the primaries for Democratic nominations, has really infused a ton of cash into this election cycle.
Are there particular races you're looking at and seeing breathtaking amounts of money being pumped in?
One of them would be the Texas Senate race, where Beto O'Rourke, a current member of Congress, has really just raised impressive sums of money, much more than his Republican opponent, Ted Cruz. We see some House races. Amy McGrath, who's running in Kentucky as a Democrat, who raised $3.8 million in a single quarter. There are previously House races that would not have cost $1 million. So $3.8 million in a single quarter is just an earth-shattering number.
Talking to Ginger Gibson from Reuters, looking at some of the top stories in national political news. Some sad news, Ginger. Former Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor announced this week she's stepping away from public life. She's revealed a diagnosis of dementia. Can you remind us of the impact she had on the court and on the nation?
Sandra Day O'Connor was the first woman nominated to the Supreme Court and really sort of broke a glass ceiling that had been there for women. She's been followed by a number of other women, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and then subsequently Hagan and other women who have come onto the court, but really was sort of the first to take that role. She left the court. We know that justices are appointed for life and they can stay there until they die. She opted not to. She has played a small public role since leaving the court and has been speaking in some places, but now she will remove herself from that. And it's Sotomayor, that is the other woman that left me there for a moment.
And then, Ginger, finally, usually when we talk to you, you are in Washington, D.C. Right now, you're actually in Wisconsin, and you're in town for a town hall event focusing on trade and tariffs. What's going on?
That's right. A group that is sponsored by business will be holding a town hall in a Milwaukee suburb tomorrow. That group is called Tariffs Hurt the Heartland. They're going to be talking about how the president's tariffs, particularly on steel and aluminum and those on imported goods from China, are affecting the local economy. We're going to hear from the Restaurant Association, from retailers, from some small business owners here in the Milwaukee area, as well as Senator Johnson, who will be talking about that impact. So I have traveled to your great state. I will take all dinner recommendations from Milwaukee to my Twitter account, Ginger Gibson, and we'll be getting the opportunity to talk to folks about what they're seeing in the trade and at their prices at their local stores when they're shopping.
And you reported not too long ago that business groups aren't just talking about these tariffs. They're spending on them. There's some political advertising going on from some industry groups.
That's right. This group is putting money in addition to these events. It's not a coincidence that they're holding this event the day after President Trump is here. They're specifically targeting places that he's going. And it's not political money in that they're saying you should or shouldn't vote for any party. But they're trying to get voters to tell their elected officials that this is something that they're concerned about and that they want them to be working to get rid of these tariffs.
And we don't always see major business groups spending against Republicans in big elections. Again, this is not direct campaign spending, but it is on an issue where they are critical of the sitting Republican president.
Yes. Normally, when groups like this are engaged in activism, it's against Democratic presidents. You don't normally see multi-million-dollar campaigns targeted at Republican presidents, but this is a position that President Trump has really run cross-eyed with business groups and business organizations. And for that reason, they are taking the fight. They say that these tariffs could really impact business such that it would undo all of the economic gains that have been made in this administration. And they're concerned about the lasting impacts they could have.
And Ginger, I want to take a few moments to commiserate. You are a Houston Astros fan, yes?
I am.
And you're in Brewers country with us today, so we are in the same boat.
We're all in mourning this week. It could have been what could have been and is not. We'll have to just dream of.
Well, I guess we could have had a heated argument if things had gone differently. And just to let you know, Ginger, our producer Chris, tweeted about you wanting restaurant recommendations. That's at Central Time WPR. So hopefully we can get some good eats for you in Milwaukee. Thanks, Ginger, as always.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Always glad to join you.
Ginger Gibson is a political correspondent for Reuters. She joined us today for our weekly look at the latest news in national politics. First, how much thought have you given about the bananas you buy at the grocery store? Maybe you just know they're yellow, they taste basically the same, they're a good source of potassium, and they're cheap. It's because nearly all bananas sold in the United States are the Cavendish variety. In fact, of the more than 1,000 varieties in the world, the Cavendish makes up nearly half of total global production. And for good reason. Their trees are short, so they tend to withstand hurricanes, they can easily be sprayed with pesticides, and they consistently produce lots of transportable fruit. But they have a big downside. They're susceptible to a fungus that's wiped out plantations in Southeast Asia, Africa, and the Middle East. Scientists are convinced that Latin America, where pretty much all the bananas sold in the United States come from, is next. Now the race is on to try to find a way to save them before it's too late. Matt Reynolds is a tech writer for Wired UK. Matt, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, thank you. It's good. Glad to be here.
Now, the Cavendish banana, that name isn't a household word. I wasn't familiar with it. But basically, if I go to a store and buy some bananas, they're going to be Cavendish bananas, right?
Exactly. So about 99% of the export market in the world is Cavendish bananas. So if you were somewhere like Thailand or Uganda or maybe even Ecuador or somewhere, you have like maybe a wide range of bananas to choose from at home. But if you're in the UK or Europe or the U.S., you think of a banana, you're thinking of a Cavendish banana.
Now, tell us about this fungus that's spreading through the banana-growing places of the world.
Yeah, so this is a fungus that was discovered. It was discovered in the late 1980s, and it's a kind of a variation of a disease called Panama disease. And what essentially happens is a fungus that gets into the banana root, and it more or less kind of chokes the banana of nutrients, and it kind of starves from the inside. And really, this is in lots of the banana-growing regions in Thailand, in China, in all of kind of Southeast Asia. And once it gets into your plantation, that's it, really. It kind of rampages through, and it'll kill off all those plantations. So it's really, really bad news for plantation owners and the industry as a whole.
Now, the bananas we eat in the United States, they're mostly coming from Latin America. This fungus isn't there, as I understand it, yet, but we're expecting it to get there at some point.
Yeah, that's right. So it's not there as we know, although some of the people that I spoke to suggest that maybe it is there already and we just don't know, and it's just, you know, not, say, in the same plantations. What it has done is it's leaped all the way from Thailand and Taiwan all the way to Australia and to Madagascar and Israel. So we know this fungus is kind of pretty capable of traversing wide distances. So the fear is that it won't be long until it does get to Latin America too.
And one thing I didn't know about bananas, about these Cavendish bananas, till I read your piece, they're basically cloned. And so there's not a lot of variation from one plantation to another, one banana plant to another.
Yeah, that's right. In fact, yeah, they're kind of completely cloned. So there's not really any variation at all, but not really cloned in like a super scientific sci-fi kind of way. Really, if you took a kind of banana plant and, you know, looked at its roots and what's underneath, it has these weird sucker things that kind of go off horizontally and then grow into a separate plant. And all that is instead of dropping a seed or being fertilized like in some other way by, you know, a bee or whatever, this plant essentially kind of reproduces. It creates kind of a carbon copy of itself and then grows in a different area. So that's really how plantation owners, you know, they grow their plants by taking these suckers and planting them to a new place. That's really bad news, because if you take a sucker from a place that has been infected, then what you've done is start an entirely new field with just an infected banana to start with.
Before we get into what people are doing to try to combat this fungus, we've been here before. You write that the Cavendish was, it used to be Plan B when the previous crop had its own fungus. What happened then?
Yeah, so the previous crop was called Gros Michel, and basically it was in the same situation as Cavendish is, right? It was the most popular banana by far. But then there was an earlier form of this Panama disease, this fungus that we were just talking about, a you know much earlier strain that's been around since the late 1800s, and that did get to Latin America. And essentially that you know did away with all of those Gros Michels. And actually, you know, to, if you talk to anyone that's actually eaten those early types of bananas, they say it was nicer, they were kind of sweeter, they're a bit kind of creamier and softer. But essentially this fungus completely did away with them. We had to switch to a banana that was naturally resistant, which is why we ended up with the Cavendish that we've got now.
So is there a plan C if we lose the Cavendish to this fungus that could meet the same needs? Cheap, durable, easy to transport, ripens at the right speed. Is there something that we could just say, okay, well, too bad about the Cavendish. We'll try this other banana.
There's no backup banana. I mean, like you were saying, the kind of the entire industry is more or less, you know, centered on this one banana. It's why, you know, for me in the UK, it's cheaper to buy a bunch of bananas than it is to buy apples that might be grown in Spain or the UK. And that's because this whole thing is, you know, predicated on this very, very reliable fruit. And so while there are loads of different types of bananas, there's 1,000 different varieties of bananas, none are really set up in the industry to actually be, you know, used at the kind of scale that we, you know, eat the Cavendish at the minute.
We're talking about the future of the banana threatened by a fungus. Matt Reynolds is with us from Wired UK. So a lot of your reporting on this, Matt, looked at efforts to tweak the genes of the Cavendish banana. So what is out there in these efforts?
Yeah, so essentially what the scientists I spoke to are trying to do is to try and keep all those bits about the Cavendish that we like. So the fact that it's robust, it takes a little while to go brown, that, you know, it's nice and tasty and it grows really easily, to keep all of those elements, but essentially just change this one thing. And that one thing is this resistance to Panama disease. So they're trying to see if they can either insert a gene from another banana that is naturally resistant or otherwise try and tweak its DNA so they can make it completely resistant. So you essentially, you've got the Cavendish, but you've just kind of given it a tiny little leg up in, you know, DNA terms. So it's, you know, gains that resistance.
There are still experiments going on. Does anything look promising?
Yeah, there are a few. So the person that's probably most ahead with this is a guy called James Dale. He's a researcher in Queensland in Australia. And he's basically already done this. So he's created bananas that are resistant to Panama disease, and he's already tested it, exposed these bananas to Panama disease. But the problem is that he's doing it using a technique that involves taking a gene from a different type of banana and putting it into the Cavendish. And that means that, at least in the UK and the EU, it falls under these kind of genetically modified organism rules that means that, you know, either has to be labeled or it's restricted with kind of growing and stuff. So we've kind of got this solution, but because of the kind of regulations around it, it's being held back, if you like.
There are other efforts, you write, that don't take other types of bananas or other types of organisms' genes and put them into the Cavendish banana. They just use this CRISPR technology, which is all over the place now, and just make a splice within the Cavendish banana gene. What's going on in that?
Yeah, that's right. So actually, you know, James Dale, again, was one of the first people to do this, you know, realizing that his current banana, you know, his cured banana, if you like, was not going to cut it with regulators and consumers. He was like, well, let's kind of go to CRISPR and see what we can do there. And essentially, you know, like you said, Rob, what you're really doing is just going into the genome itself, making quite a precise edit to try and say, well, if we take out this gene, you know, if we deactivate this, does that help us, you know, increase the resistance? And the first indications are that, yeah, that we seem to be able to do it. So the results from James's study seem pretty positive, and there's also a company called Tropic Biosciences based in the UK in Norwich is doing a very similar thing. And they're saying that, you know, you could do this to make, say, naturally decaffeinated coffee, or you could make, you know, longer-lasting fruit. So CRISPR is really being kind of thought of in the kind of agricultural world as, you know, the answer to a lot of questions.
For GMO regulators and consumers who are wary of them for various reasons, does this count as genetically modified if they haven't imported genes from other species or strains? They're just making a little deletion in this one species' DNA code?
Well, that depends who you ask. So in the in Europe, so the European Union very recently, a couple of months ago, decided that, yes, they are just the same as GMOs. So if you, edit something using CRISPR, then actually that's not quite natural, and that should be regulated in the same way and applied, have these sort of very stringent test and application process. In the States, actually, the kind of regulatory environment is a lot more lenient, and so you have kind of a CRISPR. I think you have CRISPR edited mangoes, CRISPR edited mushrooms, because essentially I think the USDA or maybe the FDA said that actually CRISPR, because it's pretty natural, you're only making quite a small edit, that's not that different to what could happen in nature anyway. So we're not going to regulate it quite as heavily. So yeah, it kind of depends where you are.
So if I'm a grower, say in South America or Central America, if I take this CRISPR technology, I might save my plantation. I might be able to sell to the U.S. I might not be able to sell to the EU, potentially, is how this could shake out.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the thing. And I think that you find this from the banana companies. So, I spoke to all the major banana companies, for this piece. And really, they're pretty reticent to say that they're doing anything that, involves gene editing or stuff like that, because it can sound like you're saying, oh, we're doing something that's unnatural or something that is, the phrase frankenfood and stuff like that gets bandied about. But I think the real thing is that this is kind of the question of whether you actually want the banana to survive at all. And maybe we're not quite at that crunch point, right? Because that disease isn't in Latin America. It's not really affecting them really badly. When actually it is a do or die moment, maybe they'll change and have to think, well, that's all we can do. So it's we're not there yet, but I think that's maybe not too far away.
Now, if this gene technology doesn't take root, I guess, if you will, if this fungus can't be stopped, what happens to our consumers' cheap banana fix?
Well, I think it's going to have to go away. I mean, it might just be that bananas and the way we set up bananas at the minute are just not very sustainable. At the minute, it takes a huge amount of pesticides to grow bananas, and it's pretty damaging to the environment, and there's all kinds of problems in terms of worker health and things like that. I mean, maybe it'll go back to what you kind of see in places in Southeast Asia, where you actually have a big range of bananas, and essentially the diversity of different crops actually, it helps the kind of food security, because if you have 12 different varieties of banana and then you get one disease, you might have 12 of those bananas wiped out, but you're not going to have the entire field wiped out. And so it's naturally much more robust. But, the flip side of that is it's more expensive to plant them. So maybe the price will go up, but we'll have more interesting bananas to eat, or maybe, the industry will just back off altogether.
Matt, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Matt Reynolds is a tech reporter at Wired UK. We talked with him about why the most common variety of banana may be on a path to extinction and how scientists are trying to save it. Right now, the First Amendment forbids Congress from promoting a particular religion and restricting somebody's religious practices. It also prohibits Congress from restricting the press or the rights of people to speak freely, and it guarantees the right of citizens to peaceably assemble and petition their government. For about 3 hours today, students at UW-Eau Claire were able to voluntarily surrender those rights temporarily in exchange for lunch. It's part of the annual First Amendment Free Food Festival put on by the Society of Professional Journalists. Taylor Pemasel is a journalism major and president of the Society of Professional Journalists UW-Eau Claire chapter. She's also an intern at WPR's Eau Claire Bureau. Taylor, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, talk us through how this works. Take us to the Democratic Republic of Freelandia.
Of course. So basically, students come in, they sign in, and then they enter Freelandia, which is just a tent and a caution taped off area in the middle of campus. And they have to stay in there for 10 minutes, and they're at the complete mercy of our dictator and our goon squad, which is a police force armed with pool noodles. And they are at the mercy of the dictator. They have to do whatever they tell them to. And after 10 minutes, then they get their free lunch.
And so what kind of First Amendment violations are going here? How would, this is obviously a simulation, but what kind of rights do they give up here?
So they give up their five main parts of the First Amendment. So a good example is people always come in with friends, and they always expect to stand by their friends and just be able to chat with them the whole time. But we take those rights away. So our dictator a lot of times splits people up and makes them do staring contests with people they don't even know, and they're not allowed to just speak and say whatever they want. And yeah, they're not allowed to stand by their friends, which makes the event really fun and different.
And do you get a lot of volunteers who do this for the pizza?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I think we had about 200 students come through today, so it went really, really well.
Now talk about the lesson you're hoping to convey here.
Sure. So even people in our organization have trouble naming the five parts of the First Amendment. So we hope when students come in, they can kind of have a fun experience and just be able to really realize and why it's important that these first five amendments should be used and should be remembered.
Talking to Taylor Pomasel, journalism major and president of the Society of Professional Journalists, UW-Eau Claire chapter, talking about a free speech exercise, a First Amendment exercise on the campus, allowing students to trade away for 10 minutes their First Amendment rights in exchange for some free pizza, and I believe soda is involved as well. Taylor, this is an annual event, right? How long has this been going on at Eau Claire?
Oh, gosh, long before my time. I couldn't tell you exactly, but we've had faculty members who claim they were around when this was still going on. So a long, long time.
And is this something that you find as a journalism major, a member of the Society of Professional Journalists, inspiring to think about the impact of the First Amendment?
Oh, yeah, of course, especially as a journalism major, too. Press is obviously involved. So literally my livelihood is included in the First Amendment. So this means a lot to me and my organization.
Now, who is involved here as the dictator and the goon squad?
Sure. So we always ask people of our organization first. And then normally we need more volunteers. So then we reach out to all of our student media. TV10 sponsored us today, as well as a student newspaper, The Spectator. We get our student radio involved. So we love to get all of the media down to help out.
And what kind of reactions did you get from the students who did this today?
Well, everyone always seems a little scared when they first walk up to the booth. We have a dictator. His name was Josh. He did a great job, but he's in a big beard and a big costume, and he's yelling at everybody and telling them to do things that they clearly look uncomfortable doing. So they always look a little nervous coming up. But once they leave, they always are like, well, that was fun, and now I get my free lunch, and I did learn a little something. So that's really fun from our perspective.
So what kind of lessons are you hoping people take away as they munch on the pizza and walk away?
Well, we hope that they at least learn their first five amendment or first five parts of the First Amendment, too. We hope they learn those. We hope they realize why they're important. Like I said, people love to come in and stand by their friends. And without that part of the First Amendment, you can't do that. You can't just say what you want. You can't practice whatever you want to. So we hope when they walk away munching on their pizza, they realize how important those five parts are and how important it is to utilize them.
Do you know if this is something that's unique to your campus there in Eau Claire, or is this something that happens elsewhere too? I've never run into it anywhere else.
I think it happens. We took it actually from a university from, I think, California or something like that. We're the only ones in Wisconsin that I know of, so that's why we're really excited about it.
And I don't know what grade you're or what level of school are you at. Are you going to be participating in this in the future yourself, Taylor?
I'm a senior, so I'll actually be handing the reins over, but I have participated the last 4 years.
And do you do other things throughout the year geared toward promoting freedom of the press and other First Amendment issues?
Yeah, in the spring, SBJ has two big events. This is the one in the fall. In the spring, we like to put on a big forum, and we love to bring like professors and faculty and members of the press in to talk about a topic. Last year we did women and journalism. This year it'll probably be something about voting. So in the spring we like to put on a big forum where we bring in community members and press and faculty to kind of talk with students about the importance of certain aspects of journalism.
Well, we'll leave it there for now. Taylor, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Taylor Pomasel, a journalism major and president of the Society of Professional Journalists, UW-Eau Claire chapter. We talked with her about today's First Amendment Free Food Festival, which portrays life without First Amendment protections. Wisconsin's voter turnout in the last election was as low as it's been for any presidential contest in the past 16 years, and predominantly black neighborhoods in Milwaukee reported some of the biggest declines. If history is any guide, even more will stay home for the upcoming midterm elections. Hamina Kondi reports on efforts in Milwaukee's black community to change that.
Derek Etherly is one of several canvassers going door-to-door in a predominantly black neighborhood on Milwaukee's north side. He's never done this before.
I'm a member of Community of Grace Baptist Church representing Souls to the Polls.
Etherly is working with a group called Souls to the Polls that recruits canvassers at churches.
Are you aware of the election that's November 6th?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Sometimes it's an easy sales pitch. The woman at this house tells Etherly she always votes.
November 6th then. All right, thank you.
Other times, canvassers have their work cut out for them. One of the people they pass is 34-year-old Derek Montgomery.
I did vote 2012. I did not vote in 2014. I am the problem.
And you didn't vote in 2016?
No, I did not vote in 2016 either.
Montgomery says he won't vote because he doesn't think it will make a difference.
I feel like it's they got their own little thing that they want to do, their own agenda that they got going, and that's what they're going to push no matter who's in office.
City election data shows a 14 percentage point drop in voter turnout in this neighborhood between the 2012 and 2016 election. Anita Johnson, who leads canvassing efforts for Souls to the Polls, blames a couple factors. 2016 was the first election requiring voter ID in Wisconsin. Johnson said that created confusion.
Some people think you need a voter ID card instead of a driver's license or a state ID.
Johnson thinks the 2016 candidates for president also played a role.
Other people just didn't like the candidates that were running, so they felt like, well, I'm not going to vote.
That could have played a factor with 29-year-old Remington Duke. As two young canvassers with a youth organization approach Duke, he applauds their work but says he won't be voting. Duke says the only politician he remembers casting a ballot for is former President Barack Obama.
I just really don't care who's governor, who's president, who's none of that. Like, oh yeah, it was a hoo-ah for Barack because he was so-called black, you know what I'm saying? But besides that, I wouldn't care.
Duke says he's busy trying to support his family. He feels whether Democrats or Republicans hold office, his best shot at seeing change in government as a black man is to leave the state.
By me voting is not going to help. You know what I mean? I need to stay focused on whatever I'm doing and how I'm going to eat, how my kids going to eat, how I'm going to pay these bills.
History suggests turnout will be even lower in the upcoming midterm election than it was in 2016. Races for governor and U.S. Senate don't get as much attention as races for president. Advocates like Johnson say they're not discouraged. And first-time canvasser Derek Etherly says it's his job to get others to believe their vote matters.
A lot of times people think that their votes don't count. But if everybody thought that way, then we would have no one voting.
While elections officials say it's hard to make predictions about turnout among specific demographics, advocates do see a sign for hope. Milwaukee saw a higher-than-usual turnout in this year's August primary. Organizers are working to continue that trend in November. Ximena Condi, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Elections in Wisconsin and around the country are just 2 weeks away from yesterday. You can find a lot more news coverage from our news team here at WPR, plus our candidate interviews on Central Time and The Morning Show. Find all that at wisconsinvote.org. That's wisconsinvote.org. Then tune in on election night for live coverage of results as they come in from us here at WPR and NPR as well. Last week on the show, a guest told us why we should write more letters, actually handwrite them and mail them to people. A lot called or emailed to talk about your letter writing habit, and a couple of you wrote us letters. Two letters showed up in my mailbox yesterday. Jean in River Falls wrote, "I absolutely love hearing your show on WPR. I listen on WRFW on my way home from work and sometimes wish my commute was longer. Thanks, Jean." And Jean says she's been corresponding with her elementary school pen pal for 42 years now. Her pen pal lives near Lake Erie, and they've actually managed to visit each other a half dozen times over the decades. We also got a letter from Michelle in Janesville. Michelle writes, "As an avid snail mail participant, letter writer, and pen pal, I was thrilled to hear you discussing this important way to communicate. In this age of impersonal and quickly composed emails and texts, a handwritten note or letter is such a lift to the spirit." Michelle remembers writing letters to family members as a kid, using college lectures as a chance to catch up on her correspondence. She says she was multitasking before it was a thing. And she continues to write now, and she's taught her children and her students to write letters and encourage them to keep it up. Well, I gotta say, we talked about on the show the nice feeling, you know, looking forward to the mail when letters come. And I'll say, seeing those in my letterbox here at work, it was really nice, given what I usually get in there, which is not very interesting. So thanks for those letters. Keep writing. Write to somebody in your life right now. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.